forth.
In the series on making moral decisions, and this fourth session is entitled, What About Moral Character? And my name is Grant Abbott, a humble Episcopal priest from St. Paul, Minnesota, trying like you to struggle to be a moral person with a kind of character that tries to combine righteousness and justice as our Lord sought to teach us. So I'd like to begin, if we may, with a word of prayer. O Lord our God, you have called us into covenant with you through your Son, our Lord Jesus Christ. Through Christ, we see how it is that we are to live and what it is that we are to be. Help us, Lord, so to develop ourselves and so to support and nurture one another, that we may grow up into the fullness of the stature of Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen. Format tonight, again, will be similar to what we have done before. I would like to get names, but actually there's so doggone many people here tonight. There are more chairs, folks. We really can make room for everybody here. I don't need a chair. Those of you who are standing, if you'd like to come and see it, you can. I don't think we have time to go around and get everybody's name tonight. I'm a little reluctant to do that because in talking about moral dilemmas, I'd really appreciate it if names are known. But what we can do when we get involved in the discussion, if you wouldn't mind saying your name, or I'll ask your name, and we'll learn our names that way. The format tonight will be, after this brief introduction, an opportunity to talk about some of the moral dilemmas on the sheet that you have. And if you don't have, we need to make sure that people get a chance sort of to share them. Upstairs, I'm afraid you just have to remember them in your mind as I read them off. They're not very complex, and they're just the starting position, and we develop them from there. And then after we've talked about these dilemmas, I want to talk a little bit about them in light of what we have talked about and what we are going to be talking about tonight, because tonight we are definitely taking a different turn in terms of the content, because those today who are urging a return to the predominance of moral character or moral virtue over questions of moral obligation are, in a sense, changing the game to a certain extent. And it'll be interesting exploring that tonight and what you think of it and getting you involved in the discussion, because that is where a lot of the new work is being done. Interestingly enough, not just by Christians, but also by former Marxist philosophers and others who are turning in this other direction. Okay, the first thing we want to do then is enjoy some discussion here. And I've obviously picked out these dilemmas because maybe they say something especially about moral character. Your 15-year-old daughter comes to you and wants to... This is number three, folks, on the front page. Your 15-year-old daughter comes to you and wants to talk to you about sex. She asks if sex before marriage is always wrong. What do you say? Why? This is the response I got when I was an adolescent, too. Yes?
I'm thinking of an article that was in the Reader's Digest a few years ago, and it was called Everybody's Not Doing It.
Okay. Everybody is not doing it. Does it make it right if people are doing it or not. What I hear, what I think you're saying is, just because everybody, quote unquote, is doing it, doesn't make it right. Okay. Why should somebody not do it? What are good reasons one way or the other here? I've got to get names. Your name was
Artis.
Okay, and Susan.
I'd asked her what she thought first to see what she was thinking before I.
Okay, Susan.
Yes.
I'm your mom. What are you thinking?
Well, she might not have any clear idea. Maybe that's why she asked.
Okay.
But on the other hand, maybe she does, and this would be a good time for her to tell you. Maybe she wants to tell you what she's been thinking.
Okay, well, I'll be your daughter then.
Does this daughter have a boyfriend?
Does this daughter have a boyfriend? Well, not yet. We're just imagining this thing right here. Mom, at school, a lot of people are talking, and I see a lot of things on television, and I go to parties. There are a lot of things going on, and I can't decide. I don't know which way to go. Sometimes I feel like I want to do things, and I'm not really sure if I want to do them or not. And I don't know.
I
feel a lot
that.
Of pressure.
I understand that. I feel that way myself. Uh-huh. And I think that's what I tell you. That I don't always know the right or the wrong thing to do either. And I just have to decide as the circumstances come up.
Okay. Anybody want to add to this?
Yes. My name is Sarah.
Sarah.
I would tell her that there's consequences to her actions, and does she want to go towards the consequences of her actions?
And what are the consequences of her actions?
Well, there's a relationship happening, and there's the consequences of becoming pregnant, and is she ready to go forward with consequences of continuing a relationship or bringing a new angle to that relationship.
Okay, Sarah, 1 second. Can everybody hear?
Yeah.
No. Maybe a little louder, okay?
Huh? A real mother, huh? No, that there would be consequences to any action that we do. And is she ready to go forward with consequences? That may be a big word, consequences of her biological needs or her emotional needs. And where does she feel that she's at in that
maturity? She's saying, Mama, I'm going to take care of the consequences. I know I can get the pill, and I can take care of getting pregnant. I know that. And just because I have sex with somebody doesn't mean I'm going to have a relationship with them.
But it does. So where are you coming from? I've raised you all these years.
Okay, let's say more about that. What I think I'm hearing you say in that is that
one comment. I think that a 15-year-old getting birth control pills is mostly illegal in a lot of states.
No, I do not. Maybe in some cases it is. Different states have different rules, but I think the right to privacy allows an adolescent to go to the doctor and get them for herself without telling the parents.
And her boyfriend can get condoms at the gas station, so it's no problem.
Yes, we hope. Unfortunately, my experience has been it's usually the girls that get the condoms and the boys, it's all their fault. But what you're saying is that you've raised your daughter in a certain way that being intimate with somebody is not casual, and there's a certain quality to the relationship that's involved. Is that what you're trying to say?
Right.
Okay.
Right. She's witnessed through my behavior.
That you've, in a sense, shaped her character in certain ways.
I've given her an example.
Okay. Yes.
I tell her it's not always wrong, because it's there's so many relationships and so many circumstances, but generally it probably is wrong that as a Christian, that I believe that that sex, sexual intercourse, belongs in a committed relationship where there is a staying together, and that sex before marriage can be a damaging thing, not always, but it can be damaging to yourself personally in terms of how you consider yourself and how you relate to other people, because without that commitment, it can be a little dehumanizing, and it could be just for self-gratification or just to please another person. There's less likely to have mutual sharing if there's not a commitment to stay together. If she's 15, I hope she can get that.
Diane, right?
Right.
Diane.
Hi, Diane.
I'm with Mama there to the degree that I would start with trying to find out from her what does it mean to her? Is it something that is just a result of biological drive and grace? Does she feel that relationship is part of it? You know, how does she see it? Why is she needing to know this at this point? Is it because she's in a relationship? Is it because she feeling pressure to not be a virgin anymore because X number of her friends are not virgins? You know, what is the meaning of it to her? In our country, the meaning is very different than in other countries often in terms of whether we expect long-term commitments or whether this is just part of adolescent behavior. It's very much part of adolescent behavior. 57%, I believe, of all teenagers are sexually active by the time they're 16 years old.
We can bring up some facts that I heard recently. The state of Minnesota, the average age of first intercourse in Minnesota is 14.4 years of age, 13.8 in the cities, and about closer to 15 in greater Minnesota. And that half, as you said, in Minnesota, it's half of the teenagers have had their first intercourse by 16. So there's some facts out there, yes.
My name is Dean.
Dean.
Many of these answers, I think, have overlooked what I would consider the fact that a 15-year-old girl really needs a simple, straightforward, understandable answer to this question to start with. This is what she's asked for. And I think the proper thing to tell her in a positive statement is, no, it is not right. It is not acceptable. I think all of these things which have been mentioned quite appropriately should follow after that as part of the discussion. I think that there is a need here on the part of a person that young, caught up in something as difficult to deal with, even at the adult level, as sexual relationships, for a clear, simple, straightforward answer.
Okay. And why would you say it is unacceptable then? I might ask, Dad, okay, it's wrong, why?
I guess I give two types of answers. One is that it is potentially harmful to you.
Okay.
Pregnancy, disease, getting into relationships you can't handle. And secondly, that it has traditionally been considered by the community, and more specifically by the church, if we can assume this is a Christian family, to be wrong. The overall impetus of the wisdom of the community, and more specifically the wisdom which God has imparted to us, gives us the message that this is not the way that we ought to run our lives.
I'm not so sure that it's God that said that this is a wrong thing. Maybe it's culture.
Well,
how old was Mary when she was pregnant?
14, maybe.
Maybe that's different. Why is that different? Because she was Mary, or was she in a different culture?
I don't think we're not talking, excuse me, Dan again. Well, I don't think we're talking about age, though. We're talking about premarital is the key, isn't it?
Well, I thought we were talking age.
Both of them are there. So it's just you're picking up another aspect of it.
Would you say the same thing to your daughter if she was 27? She came to you?
No, I think a 27-year-old deserves a different answer. No, I admit, in a sense, I am being untruthful in simplifying a very complex problem with a single answer. But what I'm saying is, I think if you're dealing with somebody on a sufficient level of immaturity, we need, in many cases, simple answers to our complex questions, at least to start with. We can go on from there. But I think in many cases, we need simple answers to complex questions.
So, Dean, you're saying the child needs a clear guideline.
Yes.
And obviously, all guidelines have exceptions and permutations as you get older and things. But at this point, given the age, that's really important and the reasons. And then, Janice, I saw you.
Jan. First, I want to know whether Jennifer's here. I think we're talking 15 here. I agree with the principle you're acting on here, though I would suggest that a 15-year-old, if I read their level of faith development correctly, probably would need a discussion of, why is this wrong? Not a clear-cut no. That would turn them off. That would cause them to possibly rebel against it. But they're ready in their stage of faith development to consider the far-reaching consequences, not just for themselves, but for the society around them. And if you were able to present a clear-cut, reasoned argument about why in society this may not be a thing to just do without thinking very clearly, that they'd probably respond better to that than a clear-cut no.
Andy? I'm Andy.
Andy?
I think the answer to give her would be no, again. And the reason for that would be a simple fact that she has questions. Okay, there's another fact here, that you can't unhave sex. You can't take it back once it's done. The fact that it might be wrong leads you to not go forward until you're sure that it's right.
Okay, I'm going to change what we usually do a little bit here and say, how would you help this particular daughter to be able to resist the temptations then going on around? Is it simply enough that she has the knowledge that the act of intercourse is morally wrong? Is that sufficient to enable her to resist temptation? Yes.
I'm Dave. Yeah. I think with a situation like this, which is pulled out of context, the context is critical, and the context is developed with the child or with any person you want to have a relationship with, that through their development and just through your entire rapport with them, that they trust you and you trust, you develop that contextual relationship with them, that you can rely upon them to be faithful and honest to you. And so I think at the time, there's really nothing else you can do. But before that, there was something you should have done.
Okay.
And I think that whenever you're working with a young person, that's what's true.
Okay. So a relationship of trust and nurture is essential.
Oh, and right from the beginning, I mean, the terminology here is sex. Well, even to a 15-year-old, what do they mean by sex? A lot of them will think sex is kissing somebody, whereas the other half, I mean, you've got to define terms from the early stage.
That's about where I was.
Yeah.
I wasn't even sure it was that. It was a long time ago. Yes, again, Diane.
I worked with a sex researcher in camp for the last year. And I think we're making a mistake if we think that kids have found a way around this, because oral sex is very much in. And if we want to get real technical and have a technical virgin over here who has not had sexual intercourse, we've got lots of gals that are engaging in oral sex. I think we have to acknowledge, I have to acknowledge the fact the child is going to make a decision. I would want her to know what my stand is and talk about that. And he's right, having started talking much earlier than they should. 15, so I don't know if this question would come as late as
15. Let's hold this then in our minds and move on to another dilemma, because we don't have all the time that we would like. Let's move down to, let's now switch to number 7. You have a job after school cleaning the lab. This could be high school or college. A friend is a star on the basketball team. He doesn't pass, or could be she, doesn't pass the final exam. He or she will be ineligible for the team. He asks you to get a copy of the exam, not the answers, so he can study for the exam. What do you do?
My name's Sarah. I'd tell him to go ask the teacher.
You asked him to go tell the teacher. Okay?
Does this college or high school or whatever have a pledge? Quite a few high schools.
An honor code, you mean?
Yeah, an honor code. Sign your name at the bottom saying I have not cheated and I have not seen any cheating.
Well, let's say it has an honor code. We'll just add that for us. Okay?
It does.
No,
Andy.
Dave. Andy. Right.
It does?
Yeah, we'll say it does. Yes.
I'm Sylvia, and it happened to me 45 years ago. I got, because of a good entrance exam type thing as a senior in high school, I was awarded a job half a year at the mimeograph machine, which I didn't know how to use, and oh boy, did I get the attention of the football team and the basketball team. But no, you don't give it to me. I didn't then, and I bring it now. Okay. It was rough, though.
Let's imagine that the you're good friends with this person. This person comes from a poor family. Maybe the only chance to make it is playing basketball. The team has a good chance to make the tournament. This person is a senior. Chance of getting a scholarship to college hangs on the chance of being able to get the team into the tournament and playing in the tournament. Yes, Dave.
I feel no matter how many conditions you put on it, you're just trying to flower it over with. And you're not, the critical issue is that some moral dilemmas or some moral decisions, there is an absolute, I feel, and in this case, there is an absolute, no, it is wrong. And if you're my friend, you should not. And there are other things as a friend you can do, you can help in the study for the exam or the tutors, but I think no matter how many conditions you put on it, how many situations you think of, you could always think of another one to make it even more severe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that once you go from that absolute, you're opening yourself up to where you draw the line. So I just.
Marjorie and then
Sarah. I'm Marjorie, and I would go with the answer, clearly in your own mind, you don't comply. Now, I'd like to say that as part of saying no to drugs, they are teaching children some steps for assertiveness. And I think there are five steps, which my son could probably rattle off. I don't remember all of them, but one is like, name the consequences, do alternatives, and finally at the last one, if nothing else works, you get up and exit the situation. But anyway, they are teaching children refusal skills and specific steps to take. And I think this, you don't tell the person you think they're a crumb for asking or that their situation is not real, but you do these other things like name alternatives and stick your ground.
Yes.
My name is Sarah, and I disagree with that. With there are some concrete moral things that you just have to stick with, and no matter the consequence or the circumstances, you have to stick by those things because I think that there are always consequences which make it completely the otherwise, and everything has to be taken in that context. And for this situation, I think that it's important that people understand the consequences of their own actions. If this particular athlete hasn't spent enough time with school, then that athlete has to understand the consequences of not doing that. But I still have problems with the consequences that they've created for themselves and the consequences that. That other things have created for them, that this is their only opportunity to get into college, that they might be feeling a lot of parental pressure, something like that. It might not be that it's their consequences that are at stake and that they should feel, but it should be someone else's consequences that, and those people should feel those consequences, not this particular athlete. I think that it would depend on them.
what happens if the person is there, you know, you, this isn't your friend this time. You just sort of are there in the lab, and all of a sudden you turn around, and there's this guy and six of his buddies. It says, I need some help. I just want a copy of the test.
I you understand? Six you understand?
How many
do
you want? Is your ex
copy?
No comprende.
What do you do? It's obvious they're not going to mess around.
And then go right. I mean, there's nothing to stop you from going and telling the teacher that there was this guy and six buddies hijacked the test. Better,
be
darn well
of
better
of
write another
there'd
one.
There'd be a lot of people. That'd be really dangerous to do.
If you,
you start
me.
Out by saying, I don't have a copy of the test. The teacher hasn't made it up yet.
Well, we know. We know that that copy's in that desk. We know. And we know also you got a younger brother. So if you rat on us, your younger brother's in trouble. Does that make any difference?
It doesn't make any difference if they're right or wrong. It might make a difference in what you decide to do.
Yes.
I think then the whole responsibility of the moral dilemma falls on the people that are threatening you to get the test.
So that in a, where you are being coerced
you don't really have
violently
you
to
don't
give
really
over
have
something, the moral obligation now is in a sense rescinded, and to resist giving it would be what's called a supererogatory act.
Yeah.
In other words, risking your own person
yeah.
for the sake of that test. Okay.
Especially in this situation where nobody else is in danger except for me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a situation where it'd be something else if these guys passed and somebody else failed. Like say if there was a cutoff, that would make it much more difficult.
I mean, isn't he asking for the answer? He's just asking for the test. At least it's that decent.
Grant?
Yes.
I'm Di.
Oh, hi Di.
And I guess to get it just didn't feel right what you said, though. I guess I've always felt that our moral decisions are based in ourselves, and you could very well decide to not give away the test, but you still should go through the practice, I guess, of knowing, being able to go through the process of imagining the consequences and practicing, and having continually practiced.
Well, what would the consequences be?
That you're going to get beat up, or that your younger brother may get hurt, or that, you know, there's always those consequences, but
okay, the
I think that the obligation of the moral decision still relies on each individual.
So that they're, what you're saying, Diane, is that irrespective of the consequences of you, and even though other people might look at it and say, you know, you really didn't have to do that because you were you and you made certain decisions, you feel personally the obligation to stand on what you believe and to act on that even though you have a good chance of getting beaten up. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that each person is responsible for their moral character, and that it's important to have a process that you run through in each case. And I'm not saying that, I'm not sure I agree with Dave in that there's absolute, but there's probably a principle, and if you run through this process, then you may decide that it's contextual, and that in this particular case, due to the consequences, you're going to decide to give over the test. But that it's a skill that you have in moral decision making, and that you practice it.
Okay. Let's change this around here for Dave's sake here a little bit. What happens if you, it's back in about 1958, and you're living in Louisiana, and there's a test to be able to vote, and all people have to be able to pass this test in order to vote, and you know the only people that fail this test because it's an idiotic test are black folks, you have sympathy with their plight, and you want to do something, and you have access to the test that's going to be used this particular election, and you know that you could give that test out. Yes.
Well, I believe that there are some absolutes. I mean, that's within to a point. I mean, you can take that point. You can also take what happened in terms of Bonhoeffer with killing Hitler. You know, there is an absolute. You should not kill. Yet here was one of the greatest Lutheran theologians who made the decision, or who came to the decision that shouldn't be happening. So yes, I think there is a higher level sometimes,
okay,
where one, you know, situation where the context can override what you feel is an absolute. And in your case, yes, the context would override it. In this case, on the sheet, no, it would not.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe there are, what I hear you saying is that there are certain absolutes, and the burden of proof is on you to say why in this situation that particular absolute is overridden by some other.
I think the burden of proof is in this, the critical factor to me in moral decision making is in the relationship that you have with your faith relationship and in prayer and reflection with God, because it's the same thing of people who would take a biblical absolute, like you shall not steal, you shall not kill. You can always use a context where that's, you're going to find a situation where they will be backed in the corner and be off of that. So I think, you know, you can, I think you have to take it in a context, and the way you find that out is through prayer and reflection with finding God's will.
Okay. Excellent. Let me say that I've used these two dilemmas that we've used so far with high school students. And the discussion is very interesting. And the most interesting experience to me was we had sort of a fishbowl experience where the kids were here and some of their parents and adults were around because we were sort of having a dinner and a party and stuff. And they got so into this discussion, it was like the parents weren't there. I was amazed at what was being said, you know, because it was like they were oblivious to their parents being there. But these issues are very real for some high school, I mean, obviously are very real for some high school kids. If you want to use them with your high school youth group, I do recommend them. But let's move on to one other one, a last one.
Could I just say one thing?
Yes,
first?
And you are?
I'm Helen.
Helen.
And I felt on the first one, the point that we missed that nobody brought up is the fact that we have the Bible to back us up on that answer. And that is our guidebook.
Okay.
And the Bible says no.
How much pull does the Bible have with a 15-year-old, though?
Pardon?
How much pull does the Bible
have with your average 15-year-old? Well, if you embrace that child in the Word of God, and if they have faith in it, then I think they will. You know, you sit and you talk to them and go through Scripture. I felt we missed that point, and that's very crucial.
That for you, in the Bible, there's a clear sense.
I would use the Bible because I taught my children that's a guidebook, and they respected it. And I think nobody said that, you know.
And that's, I appreciate that. That's important. Obviously, I mean, a Christian community would be considered in all of these discussions. Of course, the way we interpret that and the way we understand it is going to be different. That's part of our living with tension. could we move on to number six? On your way to the car after work, you find a paper marked confidential. You can't help read the paper because its main point is underlined and in bold print. It tells of the decision of the board of directors to accept an offer for the company that's far above the company's what the company's stock is now selling for. What do you do? I'm assuming you happen to have a few thousand dollars sitting around in savings.
Bye.
Pardon?
Buy.
Buy
stock.
Sell the document to a broker.
Oh, the strength of character is coming out of here. I'm going to get down to it.
To return the document to a donor.
Dean says that the obligation is to return the document. I'm going to return the document to the owner. I'm going to go to the bank. And I mean, no. You return the document to the owner, okay? But is that... What do you do with the knowledge that you have?
Nothing.
Nothing. Why?
It
someone else's property.
Okay.
It's also, I think, against the law. Is this considered insider trading that a lot of people are sent to jail for?
That's true.
Okay. I'm not that interested in making a few thousand dollars.
I think they'd ever expect you, Dean, humble person on the line, to have insider information from the boardroom.
It's not what they think, it's what I think.
I mean, your family, Dean. My gosh, you could set your kids up. You could buy some stock for Holden. I mean, my goodness, Holden could be in great shape.
At the risk of having my wife disagree with me, I'll express an opinion our family is well taken care of. It's not a problem.
But I mean, what about in a utilitarian sense? I mean, the greatest good for the greatest number. I mean, shoot, you could just think of all the people you could help if you bought this stock.
Where's this money coming from? It's from people who were investing in the market on the other side of this. My gain, their loss. What's the net benefit?
Okay, good point. Thanks.
Well, and you could go to jail, too.
You could go to jail, so there are consequences.
There's one point that you said that document is someone else's property. There's currently a big debate, especially with computer software, about intellectual property, copyrights, whether a document like that should be copyrighted. I thought it was, or could be, whether you can use that information or duplicated or whatever, and it's not so.
Okay, we're running short of time here, so I'm going to change this. What happens if the underlined in bold print says, we've discovered that our product is dangerous to the health of the people that are buying it, but we have too big an investment in it, and the decision of the board is to continue selling the product, not in the United States, but overseas.
Which is happening.
Marked confidential again. Yes.
My name is Sarah, and I would publish it. I'd publish it, just because there might be consequences for me, but the consequences of not making that information available is probably a lot worse.
Okay. So the right you have to steal that information is because of the harm that this would cause other people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the whole thing is wrong. When profits are above health, then that's wrong.
What happens if it's one of the largest employers of minorities in the state of Georgia?
There's a whole lot of minorities who are going to get hurt overseas, too.
Okay.
Are we still talking as well about this stock deal? And there's also the thing
either
going
one.
On, or not?
Either one you want. I'm just trying to make the thing a little more juicy here. If you want to go back to stock thing, that's fine.
Yeah. As well. It's what it's
yeah. I wonder about the carelessness of the person who lost the document. I mean, I really question their ownership of that information if they had dropped it.
Diane, that person was a manager. He had to get to the child care center. They closed at 5 o'clock. The board meeting was over at 4:44. He had to get like crazy out of the building and pick up his child.
That doesn't
faze me. Some of us have a certain empathy with that. It comes from experience. Yes.
My name is Pat, and I would question the accuracy of that report before I ever printed it. I mean, you could be doing some harm based on a plant.
Okay.
So you'd consider all facts before publishing.
You'd want to make sure that that was the truth in that
yes.
letter. So how would you go about doing that? What would be your obligation now? You've seen this. You're feeling the tension I sense in you. Mm-hmm. But you also feel like, is this really the truth? So what do you do?
Take the some steps in trying to determine the accuracy. One is by locating the person. You don't necessarily have to talk to them, but locating the origin of the document. And there are certain investigative processes you can go through. One, if you have someone within the media that you know whom you can trust, it's a good place to start. But you can't just publish something either. That's rotten. That's doing us much harm.
What happens if you start doing this and you try to go to the source and the source says, thank you very much, you're fired?
You're assuming I work for them.
Yes.
Maybe I don't.
If you did, you knew the risk of being fired was there, and the chances of what happens now, let's say you do get fired.
I think the threat of being fired would probably be fairly decent proof that the information was accurate.
And then you would go
then
to the
I
press.
Then I would be more apt to publish.
But you make $80,000 a year.
Yes. Aren't these fun? You can keep sort of going and going and going.
I think there's a law now that protects whistleblowers.
There is?
Yes.
Supposed to. Most apparently it's doesn't.
Well, you got
some people apparently after 16 years of litigation get back pay and stuff.
No, it's a recent law.
Right. But now, unfortunately, I have to cut this off because I want, again, to deal with another aspect of moral decision-making that's different from what we've been doing. Again, to give us some stuff to chew on and to think about as we look at these dilemmas. The last two times we've met, we've talked about two different schools of normative ethics. The deontological school of Immanuel Kant and his followers that see the most important thing as developing rules, rules autonomously that you can will to be universal laws that any rational person would accept, and you perform your actions solely based on the duty of following these laws. We looked last time at the utilitarian position of John Stuart Mill and his descendants, who say that the principle that's to be used is the greatest good for the greatest number, just to simplify things. It's a utilitarian calculation. The sense of duty is not there. Rules are not necessarily there. There could be act utilitarians and rule utilitarians, but the main thing is, does my action produce the greatest good for the greatest number? And that's the overriding concern. Both of these schools are concerned about the question, what should we do? What should we do? Yes?
My understanding of Mills is when he says greatest good for the greatest number, he is defining good in a strictly economic sense. So it means recognizable economic market value is what he means for greatest good.
His descendants have taken that. He actually has a little bit more sophisticated position in utilitarianism, where he doesn't do a whole lot with it, but he does differ the values. He talks about qualitative difference among desires and happiness. So he does make that distinction. But what I'm talking about now tonight with moral character goes in a whole different direction. And the direction is, what should we be? The primary issue is not what do I do, but who am I? And this particular school goes back, of course, to Aristotle, the Plato Aristotle, on through Aquinas, and has basically been a part of the Christian tradition up into the 19th century and even the 20th century in Roman Catholic circles, and really only dropped out of Western society because of the increasing predominance of Enlightenment values and philosophy in the West, the increasing belief in the centrality of the autonomous individual and the freedom of that individual to choose his or her own moral rules and principles. So this older school sort of has dropped out and like it never existed, even though it has been there longer than any other school, and now, interestingly enough, is coming back. The ethics of virtue is concerned with creating virtuous persons first. For virtue ethics, there's no distinction between public and private morality. Its primary concern is producing good citizens. We are primarily communal beings and not just individuals. And the concern is to try to educate people to the good, to their fulfillment, to human flourishing. Eudaimonia, or daimonia, as Aristotle referred to it, or happiness. It is as if there is a goal, and in this sense, they're like utilitarians, there is a goal, the good. We're aiming at the good, and we want to be able to help people know the good, to grow up into the fullness of the stature of Christ for Christians. And that is the most important thing to do. So, in order to do this, we find that ethics then is the study of the conditions necessary for human well-being, and politics deals with how to order persons into a community so as to achieve well-being. These two things then are bound together, the individual and the community as a whole. For Aristotle, we are social beings. For the Enlightenment, we are basically atomistic individuals, and society is there only because if we live just as individuals, we'd find ourselves in a terrible mess. Nasty, brutish, and short would be our life, as Hobbes referred to it, and others felt that, like Locke, that the government governs best which governs least, the freedom of the individual being most important, and government intrusion in that freedom seen as potentially oppressive. Whereas for Aristotle, it's totally a different way around. I mean, the individual and the community are one because we are people in community first. Yes, Dave?
I find that this discussion interesting because of how far you can draw what the points that you're making, which others have drawn, whereas, you know, in Hobbes and like the capitalistic system, which that leads in the capitalist system, and the Christian ethics, quote-unquote Christian, leads into more of a socialistic or even communistic economic system. And I think the events of the past month, that's a whole issue which is so complicated. And so, but I mean, it's an issue which I think one must question about when one tries to apply Christianity to an economic system, as to which way our beings are best organized in a Christian sense, as far as relating to one another, whether we do it, whether it has to be mandated, you know, how, which is what your point you're making, and how best can people lead a Christian life, whether it should be mandated from the government, or whether it's more of a personal fulfillment that we nurture in ourselves.
Okay. Yes.
I think, though, we generally equate democracy with American-style democracy, which is very much the individual rights. After spending 3 years about Japan, I know everything about it. So I can say authoritatively, in Japan, there is a much greater concern for the community. Your actions are never seen as being independent of other people. And it's a democracy.
But in Japan, there's very little military spending, and here in the United States.
But I'm just saying, it is a democracy. It runs on the democratic principles. They are very good capitalists, as all of us should realize by now. You know, and they have a lot of concern for not just focused on the individual. So I don't think that it necessarily has to be equated to politics, what you're saying.
Okay. That's a whole longer discussion here, but Dean.
You know, I think many of you were listening to Norm this afternoon discussing the global affairs. This statement of the unity of the individual and the total community was sort of the essence, I felt, of what he was talking about there, that we are all in one interrelated society. So I think it strikes me that there's a direct relationship between what you're saying now and what was said earlier today.
What I'm trying to say is that we have to recognize that our society has been dominated by an ethic and a philosophy of liberalism, I'm not talking about liberalism in the political sense here, but a philosophy that believes in the autonomy of the individual and the ability of reason to find the truth in nature to produce human progress, okay? And very suspicious of human community and government as interfering in the private affairs of individuals who, because of their reason, should be able voluntarily to use their freedom to enter into any kind of agreement they want to, rather than this Aristotelian sense of the fact that we are first and foremost social beings, and we really cannot find our true individuality except insofar as we are a part of a community. I'm going to say more about this tonight at Vespers, but I'm getting beyond myself here and not at the specifics of some of the stuff here. I'll go on for a sec because we're going to run out of time here, and I don't want to leave people without just understanding this stuff a little bit better here, because I think it is interesting, and there's some real problems with it that I just don't know how they're going to be resolved. Okay, for Aristotle, you have to understand we were not born with virtues. We're merely born with the capacity to become virtuous. So that training becomes very important. It is necessary that we understand the good, what a virtuous person is, and train people in order to be virtuous people. So that just starting to talk about moral dilemmas and what we ought to do for ethics of virtue is not enough. There is this whole lifelong training thing, because they see that that ethics is more than just solving dilemmas. It is about sort of living right and living well. And how do you learn how to do that? It's like a craft, in that sense, a craft of living. And so the best way to learn is to apprentice yourself to somebody who is already a virtuous person. And how do you know what is the moral thing to do? Well, you watch a virtuous person. And what a virtuous person does, those are moral things. In other words, a moral act for Aristotle was an act that a virtuous person did. That's what defined what was moral. And I think, in a sense, now I'm getting ahead of myself, digressing a little, but if you think of the knight errant in the Middle Ages, you can get some idea of this. The person who trains himself with a certain kind of chivalry and character that determines how it is that he shall live and his duties that are he is obliged to fulfill. You know, even if they might seem to somebody who is just concerned with what I should do in terms of obligations, might see as a supererogatory act. You know, why go save this damsel in distress over here? You know, there's no absolute rule, there's no good consequences. Well, I have to do it because that is who I am. It's what it means to be a virtuous knight. Yes?
But how do you determine who is a virtuous person?
That is the question, isn't it?
I think there's more problems than that.
Okay, let me deal with Dave's situation here. I'm throwing all this stuff out, folks. We're just gonna go as we go with the discussion here. Part of the problem that destroyed ethics of virtue had to do with this very fact. How do you determine what the good is, and what do you determine are the virtues or the skills necessary in order to perform that craft? The reason why this became a problem was that once you separate human beings from a particular community and a particular history, and you begin to look for universal values that apply anywhere at any time, you begin to run into very difficult problems, because how can the good for me, an American here, be the same for somebody living in Sumatra, somebody living in an Eskimo community on the Hudson's Bay, somebody living in Shanghai? How do you find this? And when efforts were made to try to do this, and you have to understand the reasons to try to do this, of course, were in competition with the Enlightenment philosophers who were trying to find these universal values that they believed at first reason could find in nature. Natural law. You know, they were written in nature. We have it, of course, in our own Declaration of Independence. And Thomas Jefferson believed that nature and nature's God revealed these things to us. And then later, of course, when we realized we couldn't do that, you could just do it by reason alone. Okay? So the radical thing that's happening now is that philosophers are saying that since the Enlightenment project itself is being called into grave question as to who is this disembodied individual who can live free of time and space. This unhistorical, unincarnated being who somehow can find universal values for everybody for all time. Isn't that a bit presumptuous? Haven't we seen that we really can't do that without biases? Don't we have to be a bit more humble and recognize that we are historical beings in particular communities, and maybe the best we can do is just to be who we are and be the best who we are, and not to think that the way we are is necessarily the way the Romans ought to be, or the way the Tahitians ought to be, or the South Africans. Okay? So there's a kind of humility to this that is saying maybe we ought to return, and especially within Christian theologians, especially Stanley Hauerwas, and secular philosophers like Alasdair MacIntyre, who's been a Marxist in the past, says, you know, wait a minute, this is all crazy. This project has to be much more humble in terms of what we are doing, and try to just figure out what it means to have integrity in our community. So Stanley Hauerwas, as a Christian moral theologian, is struggling to say the most important thing the church can do is to be itself and to develop good Christians. Good people for society who will have the courage, have the temperance, the courage, the practical wisdom, and the justice, in those old cardinal virtues, to do the right thing, sort of spontaneously, not because the law says, like President Nixon, remember the famous quote when he was interviewed? I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't break the law. You know? That there is somehow something, there's still is a moral ideal. You know, you have to say, well, I'm sorry, I don't have to do that because if I look rationally, I don't have any obligation to do that. Sorry, you're going to see you down at Lake Chelan after you've fallen into the creek, you know? I mean, that's tough. You know, tough luck. I don't have to do that. There's a sense that spontaneously somebody would do this because this is just what we do in our community because this is what a good person is. And we know that you just do that. You don't have to sit around and rationally sit and calculate, oh my God, let's see now, this girl is 13-year-old that's fallen into the river, and the good that will come to her, and I have 3 kids, and the good that will come to me, and the cost to me is, and the benefit to me is, and by now she's down, you know. So by the time you get done with the moral calculation, figuring out whether it's the greatest good for the greatest number, it's all she wrote. But it's a spontaneous kind of thing. Also, they argue that a lot of the moral philosophy that goes on in the recent past, and in secular philosophy, which the church is basically the mainline denominations have bought into, is predominantly intellectual. And in that sense, almost Manichaean, a fear of the body, of the passions. But the idea is if we can only reason well enough, we can suppress our passions, which guide us wrong always and bias us. Kant didn't want to be disturbed by the passions and the feelings. We have to be away from that. And same thing, remember, with Mill. You're supposed to be a disinterested, benevolent observer, way out and around from other things. And they, what these people say, the passions are a part of what it means to be a human being. They do tell you things. They're not necessarily bad. But you need to be able to train yourself to be able to direct the passions, to direct them in the right course, so that they do not control you, but you control them. They give energy. So they're not necessarily a bad thing. It's just not the suppression. It sounds very Gnostic, this old sense of solely intellectual and the denial of the body. So there is this coming back. However, given all that, I myself wonder, in a world in which all of us live in so many different communities, I live in my own parish, St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in St. Paul. I also happen to live with my wife's community. She's on the linguistics department at the University of Minnesota. Most of my friends back in Seattle don't have anything to do with the church. I happen to be a news fanatic, so it troubles me what's going on in South Africa, in the Middle East, in Central America. I'm a part of many different communities, and how out of this do I decide where my primary community is, how I define this, how do you build this kind of supportive community? I would give one example for us of a place that in a sense is trying to do this, and it's right here at Holden Village. Maybe without even knowing what it's doing. Here is a community that, without I think even talking about it, has a sense of what the good is and what it wants for people, and is trying to nurture that. And rather than talking about, well, you know, you have an obligation because you're one of the people here, you ought to be doing this. No, people just spontaneously say, hey, I'll help out with garbage today. You know, that's just what it means to be a part of this community. It's just something we do. You don't have to sit down and figure out if it's morally right or wrong. So it's interesting to me that maybe right here, even though we may talk in the language still of liberal ethics in that sense, in a way we live in the ethics of virtue here at Topolden. Thank you. I've got a reading list in case anybody's interested in following up some of these things. Tomorrow, on to the more difficult...